A man's shoe, a child's pink patterned winter coat, peek out from the black tarps that have become funeral shrouds. This narrow 25-meter long trench is a mass grave in the besieged city of Mariupol. The mayor says more than 1,200 people have been killed. There are no basic services. Aid groups are warning of a humanitarian catastrophe.
The only thing I want is for this to be finished. I don't know who's guilty, who's right, who started this. Damn them all, those people who started this.
Three more humanitarian corridors were expected to open on Thursday, according to the Ukrainian government. 35,000 people found safe passage on Wednesday, but thousands more remain trapped. Turkey hosted the highest level of talks between Russia and Ukraine since the invasion began. The foreign ministers of both countries met in the city of Antalya. Russia did not commit to a ceasefire or a humanitarian corridor in Mariupol.
I did my best to at least find a diplomatic solution. We also raised the issue of a ceasefire, 24-hour ceasefire, to resolve the most pressing humanitarian issues. We did not make progress on this.
In the south of the country, soldiers fought in the street. In a suburb of the capital, Kyiv, journalists reported intense fighting overnight. The Ukrainian government says Russia continues to advance with the goal of surrounding the capital.
We don't want militarization of Ukraine. You can do it even without NATO. We don't want the preservation of the tendency to create a neo-Nazi state in Ukraine. Of course we want Ukraine to be neutral.
The UN has now verified that 516 civilians have died since Russia invaded Ukraine 2 weeks ago, but says the actual toll will be much higher. In Mariupol, more burials are expected. So far, 70 people, some who died of natural causes, have now been laid to rest in this mass grave inside one of the small city's old cemeteries. Natasha Ganin, Al Jazeera.
Hundreds of people on the outskirts of Kyiv are trying to flee intense Russian shelling. People have been crossing a small river in the district of Irpin to head into the capital. The area has come under sporadic mortar fire in recent days, killing a number of people. Many plan to go to Kyiv's railway station to catch a train to the west of the country.
Many people are living in basements, their houses, their apartments, and try to leave from Irpin, from Bucha. And this is the place where people are crossing the bridge, which is destroyed. And from here, the evacuation starts. Here, territorial defense works. I'm a member of territorial defense also. So we are helping people just to get to the cars, to buses, and to move.
Let's bring in Bart Shevchuk. He is visiting senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and he joins us via Zoom from Brussels. We just heard from Kamala Harris speaking about the U.S. commitment to Ukraine and to Poland after it refused to receive and then deliver those Polish jets to Ukraine. My question for you is, what's your assessment of the American response to what's happening in Ukraine?
Well, thanks very much for having me. Look, you've seen an incredibly unified response within the whole NATO alliance, within the whole free world, in responding to Russia's aggression in Ukraine through, as pointed out, swift and severe sanctions that are going to inflict immense damage on Russia's economy. The theory is to inflict damage on the economy to exert pressure on Putin regime to change its course. You've seen 25 NATO allies and partners announce or deliver military aid to Ukraine. And this is serious weaponry from anti-tank weapons to anti-aircraft missiles, rifles, ammunition, and so forth. And we've also seen, and this is probably a little bit less visible to the public, but you know, this alliance management, this response by the whole free world doesn't happen automatically. It takes a lot of behind-the-scenes effort and consultation and planning. And in fact, the latest episode over the fighter jets from Poland to Ukraine illustrates the importance of consultation and that behind-the-scenes private discussion and coordination. And what's probably surprising is that you haven't had more sort of incidents like this. And in fact, it's been an across-the-board unified response in a very complicated situation.
With all of that equipment that you're talking about there that's gone from Europe and from the US to Ukraine, how matched or otherwise are Russia's and Ukraine's military on the ground and also in the air?
Well, you know, the assumption before February 24th was that it would take anywhere between 24 to 72 hours for Ukrainian defense forces to fold against Russia's technologically advanced military. But in fact, the Ukrainian army has proven that it has the will to fight, has the resolve and the ability to do so. And not only the defense forces, but of course, you've seen these territorial defense forces, civilians, volunteers, and across the Ukrainian population, a unified response and commitment to resist. Now, the weaponry that's being delivered to Ukraine is important because President Zelensky has declared that they will fight, they will not surrender, they will fight until Russia backs down, but they need the tools to do so. And in fact, the West and the free world at large has become the arsenal of Ukraine's democracy and resistance, just as America during World War II was the arsenal of democracy in helping the UK and other European allies resist Nazi aggression.
All right, thank you very much for your time. Bart Shifchik there, visiting senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund.
Thank you very much.
Russia and Ukraine have collectively long been referred to as the breadbasket of Europe. Together, they account for 30% of global wheat exports. But the war in Ukraine is pushing up the price of grain around the world, especially in heavily dependent regions like Africa and the Middle East. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization says Egypt imports around 85% of its wheat from the two warring sides. Lebanon gets 81% of its wheat from Ukraine. Other countries like Iran, Libya and Turkey are also heavily reliant. Food shortages could affect the lives of millions of people, particularly in developing countries. Steep price increases in basic necessities like bread, milk and meat can also produce food insecurity, famine and civil unrest. Let's bring in Abdolreza Abbasian. He is a food market expert and former senior economist at FAO and former G20 Agricultural Market Information System Secretary. Whew, that's a mouthful. He joins us via Zoom from Rome. Thank you for your time. What's your assessment of what this is going to mean for those countries whose populations already face food insecurity?
Unfortunately, it's going to be more difficult. You know, the prices have been going up for basically all basic foodstuffs at least for a year, you know, well before the current war. The war is just exacerbating the pressure on prices to go up further because, you know, people naturally expect that the there will be a shortfall in availabilities in the world market. And this we already seen in prices. Wheat, for example, which is so important for Middle Eastern and North African markets, have gained something like 40% just recently. I mean, this type of increase in such a speed has taken everybody by surprise. And I'm afraid that many countries around the world are not prepared for that.
And I was reading that some countries traditionally have consumed a lot of wheat because wheat has been cheaper than protein. So what do you think this is going to mean for people's health, I mean, longer term?
Well, again, going back to the COVID period, which still is with us, by the way, people seem to forget that, we already have seen a huge increase in the number of hungry and as well as huge increase in malnourishment. That means you're not getting the kind of quality food that you need. This predates the war. Now, with these prices, I'm just afraid that not even bread may become affordable in many places in the world. Just minutes ago in the US, they came up with the latest inflation level. It's a striking 7.9% year on year, fastest increase in 40 years. And we're talking here about highly developed country, United States. So you could just imagine the pressure right now in many parts of the world when it comes to inflation. And inflation is not just food, it's energy, it's everything. So this is also the other thing that we have to really, really contemplate on. We're not talking about food in isolation. Look at the fertilizer market, look at the energy market. All these things come together. So the pressure on especially the most vulnerable, I do not think has been greater than this since the Second World War.
Are there alternative sources? I know you're saying that it's not just about wheat. It has flow-on effects everywhere. But I guess my question is this shortage, is this price increase caused by a shortage able to be easily circumvented by planting more elsewhere? Or, like, how long does it take to make up for that loss?
I'm glad you asked this question because it's very important. If you look at the short-term period, let's say between now and the next big harvests in the Northern Hemisphere, talking about grains, as a matter of fact, we shouldn't be so worried about the shortage. Ukraine and Russia have already exported the bulk of what they would have exported in the current marketing season, known as 2020-21. There is probably like 8, 9, 10 million tons left to be exported before the next harvest. And I don't think that the rest of the world, other major exporters, would not be able to make up for that. Unfortunately, though, the market doesn't look at this. It doesn't look at what is happening the next 2-3 months. It's looking beyond. It's worried about plantings, the spring plantings for next year. It's worried about whether the fact in these countries, especially in Ukraine, I would say, there will be orderly harvesting that will take place, and that next year Ukraine will be able to export or not, or how much of Russian wheat will make it to the world market. This anticipation of next year, next season, I would rather say, which is 2020-23 season, next season not having as much as even this year, is what is fueling the price increase. It's inevitable. We're all humans. We're all worried about the future. What do? We go and buy now. We try to buy now. And there is a bit of a speculation there, which is also fueling. So I'm very worried about this because the prospects do not look good. But if we want to be realistic, we have to accept the fact that today, as we speak, we do not have a shortage. What we have is lots of fear, and that fear has added is the one that drives up prices.
All right. Hey, thank you very much for your time there, Abdolreza Abbasian, food market expert.
Thanks.